Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Today we'd like to talk a little bit about Pakistan and where everything's standing there. Everything continues to be in flux, and the relationship with the Pakistanis and the U.S. seems to be still troubled. What's the current status, Jim?
Well, currently there is a crisis in a governmental crisis in Pakistan, where there is talk of another coup d'etat from the military, and the military is acting as though there's a huge crisis going on, that Pakistan is under attack. And at the same time, they are under threat of losing billions of dollars a year in military aid from the United States. And it would appear that the high command of the Pakistan military doesn't know quite what to do. They haven't got many options left. They cut off supplies, but the supplies are still coming in from, the Caspian and Central Asia. In fact, most of them have been coming in, and we plan to have almost all of them, by early next year, coming in from the northern route, as it's called. Pakistan just announced that they would shoot down any American drones that were seen over Pakistani territory, where they've been operating for, almost a decade. Interestingly, there has not been an American UAV, drone attack for over a month, since I think November 15th. I was told that was because we didn't want to, do anything to inflame the military-controlled, PR machine in Pakistan any more than it already is. Basically, the military and the Islamic conservative politicians in Pakistan work together to use the media they control to be more patriotic than thou when it comes to situations like this. That's what happened when Osama bin Laden was killed. The first thing he said was, oh, a terrorist leader is dead. No, we've been invaded. Oh, my God, what a catastrophe. And bin Laden was considered collateral damage. The main problem was, the Pakistan had been invaded. So now they're talking about shooting down American drones. And that is serious because basically the biggest complaint of the terrorist groups in the two areas, Pakistan allows to exist as terrorist sanctuaries. That's North Waziristan and Quetta, the largest city in Balochistan, which is right across the border from Helmand and Mission Kandahar provinces. Without those attacks, the terrorists can basically get reorganized and get back into action. The terrorists apparently are aware of this because they have reduced the attacks they've made in Pakistan in the last month or so, and they've increased the attacks that they've sponsored as far as the Afghans are concerned inside Afghanistan. So what you have here is that the Pakistan military is basically aiding the Pakistani-based terrorists, taking the pressure off them, especially the American UAV attacks. And in return, those terrorists are increasing their terrorist attacks in Afghanistan and reducing them in Pakistan. So the Pakistan military is basically selling its soul to the devil for God knows what, because right now Congress is talking about cutting the aid. Whether or not, Obama will sign off on that remains to be seen, but if Congress doesn't authorize the money, it's just not there, no matter what Obama does. So Pakistan is in big trouble, and it's mainly the military who feel that their interests are being attacked, which they are and have been. I mean, the Pakistani military is upset at a number of things that have happened this year. Started off with, bin Laden getting killed in the way he did and where he died. Followed up by months of pronouncements by senior American officials, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of Defense, et cetera, criticizing Pakistan openly for what Pakistan has been doing for years, that is supporting terrorists or preventing attacks on their key, you know, base areas. So the Pakistani military, you know, instead of doing what we think is the right thing, that is go after the terrorists, they're basically saying, oh, you're attacking Pakistan, and we have to defend the country, including its apparently its terrorists.
Austin?
Well, and there's nothing to add to what Jim's summation of the current chaos. I like the way he puts it, that armies going to the dark side, definitely. This is something that I would bring to our listeners' attention. I wrote an article this summer entitled Restitching the Subcontinent, and I'll sketch it out here in a moment. It ran in the Weekly Standard on November 28th, 2011. Maybe we should put a link up on strategypage.com. And basically what it suggested, I know Jim read this in draft, was that one of the greatest geostrategic errors of the 20th century may have been splitting India into East and West Pakistan and India. I'm talking about British India. And, you know, Bangladesh, which is East Pakistan, was East Pakistan, is quiescent, comparatively. But the problems that have afflicted Pakistan with only brief interruptions, particularly since the 1960s, and here Jim describes how they have just gotten worse, indicate that, look, the modernizers, and I'll take that to be the primarily the Punjabis and the Sindhs and the productive portion of Pakistan are in a way pitted against the hill tribes. And when Jim talks about, you know, conservatives in this part, he's talking about cultural conservatives who really don't have much of an economic agenda other than the ancient type of, you know, whatever we can steal from our enemies. I was going to say our neighbors, but then oftentimes your enemies could be, you know, more valleys away than your neighbors. So the article in one way is either, as I've said, 60 years too late or 50 years too early, because Pakistan doesn't have the, well, demographic depth or strategic depth to deal with the onslaught from the hills, tribal chaos, the quote-unquote culturally fossilized elements. That's a better way to put it, because if you say conservative or liberal, it sounds like people get confused talking about trying to relate that to North American or European politics, and it doesn't quite relate in the same way. In fact, it doesn't relate at all when you realize that most quote-unquote Western conservatives are really 18th century liberals. But the concept behind the article was that at some point maybe you restitch the subcontinent. And what it does is it would ultimately provide Pakistan with a demographic and geostrategic depth that it once had when it was British India. Could be at one way said an utterly far out idea, but the lesson out of the article is that that's a way to go about talking about Pakistan's systematic and systemic failures, which is what Jim was describing the current situation, which is it's just gotten worse. So I bring that up. I'm not going to, go any further into it, but I certainly had some discussion to support why at least a level up here used to talk about the Islamists, the militant Islamists as political and cultural fossils. But, the thing that was so sad about the separation, and I include a couple of stories, personal stories from people I had spoken to or interviewed over the years about the split when it comes in the late 1940s, is that you had Hindus in Karachi who were economically contributive, and Muslims in what is now the nation state of India that were, this is where they were from. This massive shift of populations that was not productive, that still exacerbates, and that some of them still wonder, why did we do it? Because there was an economic and cultural commonality, not just between Hindus and Muslims, even though that's the substantial portion, but between the other groups that were broken up as well. So one thing that I can hear Jim Dunnigan coming back and saying is actually, I think this cropped up on a strategy talk maybe 4 or 6 weeks ago, was that, you know, who wants Pakistan? The Indians want it. The Indians have had some degree of success, really comparatively an extraordinary degree of success, economic development, particularly over the last 20, 25 years. Pakistan, further and further back, you know, it's certainly in comparison to its former partner in what was you know, Greater India, British India. And the Indians, whether they're Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, or any of the other several dozen religious faiths that are several dozen. You could, there are more figures on that on some of those sects that are in India to show you that there are more than just several dozen more, a couple of hundred more. Why would they want Pakistan? Pakistan becomes one of those places, as Jim has said in the past, that no one wants, comparing it to unfortunate places like Somalia. Afghanistan, to some degree, being a place, there are things you want about it, but you really don't want the fragmentation, lack of cooperation, violence and violent actors that come along with it. So maybe we'll put a link up on the site then.
Okay.
At least to that Weekly Standard article.
Jim, what's the current situation with the U.S. military being able to get supplies through Pakistan?
Well, the trucks are still held up at the main crossings. There's one in the south, and then there's one main one, the Khyber Pass, and actually a secondary one up in the northwest. They're not letting them through, but, you know, again, contingency plans were always in place for this sort of eventuality, so the Pakistani military is playing chicken, because the longer this goes on, the more likely they are to lose all the aid from us. And we go back to the situation in 2001, where we told them, you're either with us or you're against us. Now, the question is, does Obama believe that, you know, playing this other, you know, George Bush card, is it going to help them or hurt them? Because that's what it comes down to. Are they basically going to join the terrorists? And there's a huge amount of debate within Pakistan on this very issue, because many Democrats, shall we say, as opposed to, you know, pro-military or pro-Islamic, you know, religious dictatorship types, they are basically, I mean, they're all, you know, patriotic Pakistanis, but they all are suspicious of what the army is doing. And you know, some have raised the specter of, are we going to go to war with the United States? For what? What's the reason? The generals are, you know, not making any sense. And then other commentators say, well, they've never made any sense. The army for a while, for a couple of months, especially after Bin Laden got taken down, they were threatening and in a few cases murdering journalists. And a lot of Democrats want the army, you know, commanders, especially in the ISI, brought to justice. Now, this has never happened before, bringing these guys to justice. They basically have their own death squads. They do what they want. And that's a big issue in Pakistan at the moment. So there are two conflicts going on here between Pakistan and NATO, essentially. And the other one within, you know, within Pakistan, between the military and the rest of the country. And the military benefits, you know, maybe 5% of the population tops, you know, counting all the hangers-on and what have you. And they basically live off the other 95%. And the other 95% are not happy with this, but, you know, the 5% have all the guns, or most of them anyway, and they occasionally show they're willing to use them. But And as we've explained many times in Strategy Page, you know, half the time Pakistan has been in existence, they've been run by a military junta. And after a while, the people get so upset that the junta says, all right, let's have democracy again. And then, you know, goes on for, now, we've only had democracy in Pakistan for 3 years. Usually, you know, 5 or 10 years of democracy before the military says, oh, this is terrible, we have to take over again. But this is an unresolved issue, which is, you know, heading for a very bloody clash. I mean, the whole Arab Spring thing upset the Pakistani military. They said, oh my God, you know, a lot of those were dictatorships, you know, held up by the military. And gee, you know, we do that sometimes. Maybe people are angry.
Well, you catch some of this. This is one of the point about some of the commonalities actually extend between India and Pakistan. You can find some of what Jim's talking about on the web and Pakistani publications in English. What's their business language? Well, it happens to be the same business language that India has. It's English. And you have a large number of English speakers in Pakistan, and the debate Jim's talking about, you can find it, those elements, not just, you know, at the rumor stage, but on the web. Point out that the military itself has factions, and we've talked about the civil war that goes on within the Inter Services Intelligence, ISI. It is a fractious mess. But as Jim says, who has the guns? Well, it's the military and security agencies, intelligence agencies. Are they fighting at some level a rear guard battle for their own survival with the people? You know, all the folks that are tired of the dictatorship. That's one way to frame it. That's part of the way Jim was framing it a minute ago. Could be. We don't know yet. We certainly know that.
Well, what people are most upset about is the corruption, the way the military basically aids and abets the corruption, and is itself a corrupt, you know, operation. And this has been an issue within the military, you know, for most of the last decade.
Oh, yeah.
And several chiefs of staff, you know, heads of the military, have come up with reform proposals to basically share more of the money with the troops. I mean, that was becoming a major issue. The officers live extremely well, especially the higher up in rank they get. Whereas the troops, you know, they get by, hey, it's a job. Hey, this is Pakistan. Be grateful for what you got. But, you know, some of the troops are getting a little surly. And so there were several programs in the last, especially in the last 5 years, to give a little bit more to the little guys with guns. The public has finally become aware, the internet has played a large part in this, that we're paying for all this. The rich people don't pay any taxes. The people in the middle pay the taxes. People at the bottom, everybody pays taxes, but the generals and the richest families. And this is becoming a big issue, which obviously the generals and the wealthiest families would rather go away.
Right.
See similarity to some of the themes that run through Arab Spring. The thing is, though, the corruption complaint is not simply an Arab Spring phenomenon. You find that globally.
But in this instance, if there's probably going to be a lot more people shot if something starts happening.
Well, you got to remember that in Pakistan. Pakistan has always compared itself to India. And ever since the 90s, when the Indians finally wised up, you know, that, hey, this socialism, you know, thing they adopted in the 1950s isn't working. And they did what China did. China was what really got the Indians' attention. They said, hey, why are Chinese getting richer and we're not? Aren't we superior to them, et cetera, et cetera? Well, they basically made the same reforms, and the Indian economy has been booming. And the Pakistanis are looking at this and said, well, why aren't we getting rich? What's different aside from religion? And, of course, they don't want to believe religion has anything to do. Actually, it doesn't. But it's the corruption, and it's a whole bunch of other things that need to be changed. And the people who would not benefit from the changes are resisting this.
Well, when they separate from India, when they separated from India, they shifted their their demographics and towards even further a lack of economic development and cultural backwardness. Their comparison, they want to compare themselves constantly to India. And at some military level, I mean, even though India is much more powerful than Pakistan militarily, their military capability, okay, they compare somewhat to India, but their real standard of comparison is the other way, where they compare themselves to Afghanistan. I mean, it's politically fractious and broken apart as the, not quite as Afghanistan, but that's more reflective of their state. They're more like Afghanistan than they are India. And that's sad to say, given...
They don't like that comparison.
Oh, I know they don't.
And most Pakistanis don't like it either, and this has been debated. Fortunately, you know, there's a lot of English-language Pakistani, you know, websites, news sites. And you can go read these. Sometimes, you know, Americans will find it hard reading because they can be extremely, you know, offhandedly anti-American. But when they get to discussing their own internal problems, it's quite illuminating. They're aware of these huge problems, but they can't quite find a way to, you know, deal with them. And this is liable to end very badly for everyone.
Just what I just said would light those people up. You know, I'm sure if there's somebody listening on that, but you know what? Think about it, because I think the comparison, that's where Pakistan has placed itself over the after the last 30 years, as India has modernized economically, and Pakistan has not only stagnated, it's used the term fossilized about certain cultural elements there. That's what's happened with this, with the corrupt dictatorship, corrupt authoritarianism that exists within the country. So
yeah. So Jim, the supplies that are getting into Afghanistan right now then would all be being airlifted in, correct?
They're coming in from the north, and okay. As always, emergency stuff gets flown in. But they always keep 30 or more days supplies. And they have been, I mean, I've been told this many times, they have always acted for years that, you know, the Pakistanis cannot be trusted, you know, to keep those lines open. So they have made contingencies, which I don't know why they don't like to talk about it. I guess they just don't like that issue being, you know, brought up too much for whatever reason. But, you know, it's the Pakistanis who have the big problem here because they have more to lose than we do.
Right. C-17s are very nice, though, that they provide you with some interim backup. I'm talking our cargo aircraft, U.S. Air Force ability to transport aircraft, and that's an expensive way to do it. You can with essential supplies to back up, given our capacity. I know we're in a military budget decline era of military declining Department of Defense budget, but C-17s are a nice aircraft, aren't they? They really are.
Yeah.
This is an example. They provide you with a political element to say, okay, you cut it off. Yeah, you know, we have a airframes that can...
Now, the next thing the Pakistanis can threaten to do is cut off air access.
Right.
That becomes serious.
Well, they could do that. They could do that.
And that's where they take a step towards war. Now, the Pakistani politicians are telling them, now, look, we're not going to back you. A lot of them are saying this openly. We're not going to back you in war. If you want to go to war with the Americans, you're on your own. You have not got a country behind you, because a lot of the, you know, the military won't admit this, but a lot of the politicians realize that, hey, where are most of your aircraft from? United States. How good are you compared to the Americans? Not even close. So how long is your air force going to last? Now, all right, they say we've got nuclear weapons. Fine. How are you going to deliver them? We can give them to terrorists. Well, the Americans are already aware of that. What do you think is going to happen to your nuclear weapons if you go to war with the Americans? And it goes on like this. This debate goes on, you know, in Pakistan, and the generals appear to have just freaked out. You know, they have no options. They have no support from their own countrymen. They joined the dark side, as it were. The only allies they can find are Islamic terrorist murderers. So you know that they're in a very bad place. literally.
Well, look, it's still look. Here's a way that you route it. You could you fly the routes out of Eastern Europe, Turkey. You pay exorbitant overflight rights to fly over Central Asia and come down and land at Bagram from.
Oh yeah, no, we have overflight rights with Russia and Central Asia. The trouble is, it's a lot more expensive.
And despite what the Russians would say and Putin about Hillary Clinton trying to wage war, political war, or whatever in Russia, the Russians would just love to get those overflight fees. So there you are.
Well, they're already getting them. They just aren't getting that many. And, of course, they want more. I mean, Putin has his own problems right now.
What about the transportation charges through the former Soviet republics and Russia, Jim? Do you know, have they jacked the fees? Is the Pakistanis cut it off? I'm curious.
No, they have not. They tend to be rather manageable because they see us as leverage against the Russians. It's, you know, for them, it's back to the old Cold War days, which, you know, they only saw as spectators.
That's good. That's good to know.
Yeah. Well, I
think we've hit a point for this.
Yeah. The supplies coming in through there, through the north, are going to be extremely, extremely expensive, though, because they have to be trucked through Turkmenistan.
No, they're not trucked. They come by railroad to the border. There are transfer stations at the Afghan border, which is better than the deal that you get with the Pakistanis, where you got to truck it to over 1,000 kilometers, you know, from Karachi. Because the Pakistani railroads don't go right into the tribal territories carrying freight. It is alleged to be more expensive because most of the supplies have to go to the southern Afghanistan, where most of the fighting is going on. So it is more expensive, but you know it's a much better deal because nobody wants to mess with those supplies on the way in. The northern part of Afghanistan is very friendly. That's the old Northern Alliance territory. Once they get down south, they haven't got any more problems than they had, you know, in the past. Actually, come to think of it, the way the supply routes go, they're going through less hostile territory coming from the north than they are coming from, in effect, the south, or the east, through Pakistan. And we've told the Pakistanis that. And the Pakistanis, you know, they hem and they haw, and, you know, basically performance says everything, and they just haven't performed. So they yell and scream that they're going to lose all this business, which they're already losing. They've been losing, they've lost about half of it already to the northern route, but they have only themselves to blame, and they don't like to accept blame. That's another Pakistani problem.
Right.
Well, Dan, we've hit this pretty hard today, so we're...
Yeah. Well, let's transition and talk just for a couple of minutes on something that's left us all scratching our heads a little bit, is the the loss of the drone in Iran. I've had people emailing me, Jim, asking what's going
on. I shook the tree, the intelligence tree we have. My usual sources... And either nobody knows nothing, or what little they know, they don't want to repeat in any way, shape, or form. So nothing is really known how it came down. It's a mystery within a mystery within a mystery. The Iranians say they took control. They basically seized its communications link, which is via satellite. Now I basically ask people. I have people I know who are satellite comm experts, and they say, well, the Iranians have interfered with satellite signals to jam them, but as far as interfering an encrypted control, you know, channel, and taking it over, it works in the movies, but not in real life. So that's a very long shot. Now the control software that is used that can allow an aircraft like this, when it loses its signal, its control, it might have been jammed. It's supposed to turn around and return to home. It's got GPS. Now, basically, nothing makes sense with all this, and the government isn't saying anything. So, basically, it's a great big mystery. That's why we haven't put anything in Strategy Page. We do not go in for speculation. And all you've got right now is speculation, which means we don't know. It's possible, from what I've been hearing, that the U.S. government isn't sure. Now, the question is, why did they not bomb the UAV when it came down? Well, the only comment I've gotten, and this was not authoritative, was that we didn't know where it was.
Which also seems strange.
Now, well, no, we've lost the loss rate on UAVs, the large ones, you know, Reaper, Predator, Global Hawk, is much higher than for manned aircraft because there is not somebody on board who can basically feel the plane or, you know, and basically sense and diagnose and fix problems quickly. Doing it remotely does have its problems. And things, you know, fail. And, you know, it's still a learning process. We've only been using these things heavily for about 10 years. So we're still in its infancy. So it's quite possible that there were multiple system failures. And the thing landed by itself, you know, someplace, you know, maybe without the landing gear down. And Iranians, you know, got a call from some farmer out in Podunkville, you know, and says, hey, you know, actually that area along the border, it's, assuming it came down in the border area, that is heavily patrolled by the police and the Basij, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, looking for drug smugglers. So, you know, the place is covered regularly. And somebody said, hey, what's this funny looking, you know, it's a flying saucer. You know, who knows what went on? The Iranians, and there's nothing coming out of Iran. I mean, although the area is heavily patrolled, you know, rumors come out. Now, if we wait, what I'm doing is waiting. The longer you wait on something like this, eventually something comes out. We know what happened. The thing disappeared. The Iranians have shown pictures which appear to be it. But as Dan pointed out earlier, it doesn't really look like any other pictures we have of that are 170, you know, RQ-170 UAV. So, you know, do they really have it? Did they just take, you know, somebody, it was reported that it was lost along the border, so the Iranians said, hey, you know, they make stuff up. They make a lot of stuff up. They get caught at it frequently, too, and that doesn't dissuade them. So they love to lie. So maybe they're just making this all up. We don't know. For all we know, the thing went down, you know, hit a mountain, and the pieces are out there somewhere, and nobody's found them.
Well, we're not even sure if it's a 170. It could have been a Predator, which...
Well, no. The mistake was admitted. They you know, a 170 has disappeared while flying along the board.
Because the reports I had read was that they hadn't said what model it was. So,
I've had people
in the government tell me that, you know, offhandedly, you know, it was a 170. Now, it may be true, you know, that they are just picking up on the conventional wisdom, which is often wrong. Be that as it may, nothing official has come out about, you know, what exactly is going on here. So in a situation like that, true to our mandate, is we just keep, you know, quiet until there's something to actually report on, to analyze. Right now, there's nothing but, you know, smoke, and you can't really analyze smoke very well.
And it just, yeah, and that smoke smells like
exactly that. Right. So, if you're writing fiction, you know, here's an opportunity. You know,
right. Here's a great plot line.
Exactly. Run with it. But you know, right now, there's no there.
Right. Okay, well, we'll leave it at that, and we'll probably not talk to you gentlemen until the beginning of next year, and so we'll want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Take care. Happy holidays.
Take care. Bye.